My name is Jim Ferguson. I'm with the University of Manitoba, and it's my pleasure to moderate the last panel of today's sessions on law and counterproliferation. I'm not going to go over the rules of engagement. I think everyone is well aware of them. But I will emphasize, the organizers emphasized to me to be ruthless in enforcing time and short questions, et cetera, et cetera. So I shall, to the best of my ability. I'm going to begin by giving just a very brief introduction to the members of the panel, and starting in reverse order. From my far left, Julian Schofield, from the Centre d'études de politique étrangère et de sécurité, not bad, from Concordia University, not bad from an anglophone from the West. David Mutimer from the Center for International Security Studies at York University, and Claude LeBlanc, who's the Director of the Arms Control and Proliferation Policy Directorate in the Department of National Defense. And our presenter for this afternoon is Professor Mary Ellen O'Connell, who holds the Robert and Marion Short Chair in Law and is Research Professor of International Dispute Resolution, Kroc Institute for Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Professor O'Connell.
I want to sincerely congratulate the organizers of this conference for the topic that they chose. It's truly an important one. International security challenges and the law constraining or enabling effective policies. Despite the negative option in that title after the colon, that law could, in fact, be constraining of effective policies, I still think this is a very important topic because we're really not discussing international law, especially with respect to the resort to force, very often in the United States. And I find this particularly puzzling when you consider that the United States is currently involved in two armed conflicts, which we could have avoided, certainly avoided being in the difficulties where we are in, if we had in fact complied with the international law on the use of force. It would seem to me that everyone should be discussing the topic of this conference to see international law as a fresh new alternative to help us avoid the problems that we find ourselves in now. But I also find that this idea of law, international law in particular, as a straitjacket is very deep in U.S. policy. I traced it in this new book that I have, The Power and Purpose of International Law. I trace why in U.S. foreign policy this view of international law as a straitjacket is so deep. And it seems to me it has a lot to do with someone I think we all know well, the great international relations theorist from the University of Chicago, Hans Morgenthau. Marty Koskenniemi, a prominent international legal theorist, said this about Morgenthau. For Morgenthau, competition for power and security that was the essence of international politics. The dangerous and unpredictable conditions of international politics made it imperative that decision makers be freed from formal rules or dogmatic moral principles that tied their hands when prudence and innovation, what Morgenthau called wisdom, were called for. Well, in fact, I think the real wisdom is found in international law. And I hope we return to this real wisdom. After all, international law, especially the rules on the use of force, governing resort to force, are more than 400 years old. They're a set of principles that have withstood the test of time, that incorporate our very deepest moral commitments, and that have a certain pragmatism, practicality, or they wouldn't have lasted, as I think Marco Sassoli so eloquently pointed out in the opening address today. Let me then exemplify why I think international law on the use of force, on governing resort to force, is wise and is pragmatic and is reflective of how we should go forward, especially in this area of counterproliferation. I want to discuss the international law rules on counterproliferation in the particular case of Iran. Now, my co-panelists will tell you that we've been discussing Iran with regard to this this conference for some months now, and we didn't just come up with it because it happens to be so much in the news as we speak. But it is timely, And I very much hope that our decision makers will turn back to the rules on international law for guiding their conduct in the coming weeks and months. Iran is, of course, a non-nuclear party to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. As such, it is bound not to develop nuclear weapons, but may engage in peaceful nuclear activities. It may, for example, build nuclear power plants. Iran has announced an intention to do just that. But in February 2006, the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, resolved that Iran must suspend, quote, all enrichment-related and reprocessing activities, close quote, in light of the IAEA's finding that Iran had resumed uranium conversion activities at one of its facilities in August 2005, and that it was taking steps to resume enrichment activities as of 2006. The board requested that Iran reconsider its position in relation to confidence-building measures and provide credible assurances regarding the absence of undeclared nuclear material and activities in Iran. The Security Council in July 2006 demanded that Iran take steps, the steps required by the IAEA, by the IAEA Board of Governors, which are essential, according to the Security Council, to build confidence in the exclusively peaceful purposes of its nuclear program and suspend all of its enrichment-related and reprocessing activities. This is the situation we're still in, with the Security Council and others trying to convince Iran to suspend enrichment activities and to allow inspectors into the country to give the world assurances that it has suspended them. We've been working toward this goal for all these years, and yet this week we find out again that there is a secret facility at Qom, so obviously we're not succeeding. But what are the international law rules on the use of force in a situation precisely like the one we're facing now with Iran? As you all know, in 1945, with the adoption of the United Nations Charter, we agreed to a core prohibition on the use of force. The United Nations Security Council was created to enforce this prohibition, and while states have tried since 1945 to expand on the right to use force, to dilute the prohibition against the use of force, as of today, we remain with a very firm general prohibition on the use of force. The international community has reiterated time and again that it is standing by this strict prohibition on general use of force. And it did so authoritatively at the 2005 United Nations World Summit in New York, where it said again that the Charter remains the law for the international community, including the general prohibition on the use of force in Article 2, Paragraph 4. And the world said there are only two exceptions to the right to use force prohibited by Article 2, Paragraph 4. That's Article 51, which permits individual and collective self-defense, and Articles 39 and 42 that permit the Security Council to authorize force in the face of a threat to the peace, breach of the peace, or act of aggression. The International Court of Justice has also constantly reiterated in many decisions stretching from 1948 until 2005 that the rules of the Charter are the governing rules for the international community on the use of force. I know of no government in the world that has renounced these Charter rules. Of particular importance in the actual context of using force against Iran to counter proliferation, the Security Council spoke in 1981 condemning Israel's bombing of an Iraqi nuclear reactor. And the ICJ has given a very specific decision relevant to this context in its advisory opinion, Legality of the Threat or Use of Nuclear Weapons. Article 2.4's general prohibition on the use of force aims at fulfilling a primary purpose of the United Nations, its aim to ensure by the acceptance of principles and the institution of methods that armed force shall not be used save in the common interest. The language of Article 2.4, mandating that states shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force, creates a fundamental presumption against the use of force. Article 2.4's general prohibition is modified only by these two exceptions that I mentioned. The Security Council's right in Article 39 and 42 to authorize measures, including armed force, to maintain or restore international peace and security, and Article 51's guarantee of the right of inherent self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a member of the United Nations. The Israeli scholar Yoram Dinstein has emphasized that UN members under these rules are barred from exercising self-defense in response to a mere threat of force. It is noteworthy that even if Iran is in possession of nuclear technology in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, mere possession of nuclear weapons does not constitute an unlawful threat to use force, let alone an armed attack. The International Court of Justice addressed this issue in its 1996 advisory opinion on the legality of the threat or use of nuclear weapons. It concluded that the mere possession of weapons did not necessarily violate the Charter or general principles of international law. The court said, whether nuclear weapons pose a threat contrary to the UN Charter depends upon whether the force envisioned would be directed against the territorial integrity or political independence of a state, or against the purposes of the United Nations, or whether it would necessarily violate the principles of necessity and proportionality. Indeed, in making its decision, the ICJ emphasized the tension between the emerging norm to prohibit the manufacture, possession, and use of nuclear weapons and as represented by current non-proliferation treaties on one hand, and the continuing practice of nuclear deterrence on the other hand. For some scholars, such as Professor John Yu, famous for having written the first of the torture memos, despite the plain words of Article 51 and other provisions of the Charter and the International Court of Justice's jurisprudence, he believes that force may be used in the absence of evidence of an armed attack. He argues that a right to preempt force exists in customary international law, law that existed prior to the adoption of the UN Charter in 1945. And he says that this continues to be open to states through the Article 51's reference to an inherent right of self-defense. This interpretation, however, requires reading out express terms of Article 51. Such a contorted interpretation is simply not necessary if one accepts that the inherent right of self-defense, the pre-existing right, continues. States still have this right, but it is now limited since the adoption of the Charter to situations where there is evidence of an armed attack occurring. The negotiating history of the Charter makes clear that this was the correct interpretation that the drafters intended. What we find in general international law beyond the Charter is also very important and not often discussed. With respect to the right of self-defense, there are additional principles than the causes for which states may resort to armed force in the Charter, and these are the principles of necessity and proportionality. In the 1840s, the United States and Great Britain corresponded about a use of force on the Canadian-U.S. border that involved the sinking of the ship Caroline. U.S. Secretary of State Daniel Webster described what a legitimate use of force would be, and it was one that is not unreasonable or excessive and is limited to when the necessity for the use of force is instant, overwhelming, leaving no choice of means and no moment of deliberation. These requirements of reasonableness, in Webster's term, what we would say today, proportionality, and necessity, continue in force. Thus, in addition to the lawful basis in the Charter, states using force must also show that force is necessary and can be carried out while respecting the principle of proportionality. States must be able to show that force can achieve a legitimate objective as set out in the Charter. If they can make the necessity showing, they must also show that the method of force will be used, will not result in disproportionate loss of life and destruction compared to the value of the objective. Necessity and proportionality are not expressly mentioned in the Charter, but in addition to this history continuing forward, I would refer you to Judith Gardam's book, Judith of the University of Adelaide, who provides impressive authority for the existence of rules of customary international law and general principles of law of necessity and proportionality. As the ICJ said in the nuclear weapons case, quote, there is a specific rule whereby self-defense would warrant only measures which are proportional to the armed attack and necessary to respond to it, a rule well established in customary international law. This dual condition applies equally to Article 51 of the Charter, whatever the means of force employed. In sum, today, unless a state has received previous authorization from the Security Council, international law requires that a state be the victim of an armed attack, that the armed attack must either be underway or the victim has already been attacked and has clear and convincing evidence that another attack will soon occur. The state being targeted must be responsible for the significant attack under rules of state responsibility. And finally, the force must be necessary and proportional in the context of self-defense. Necessity and proportionality also governs any use of force authorized by the Security Council, even if it believes that there's a reason to use threats to international peace and security. The force it authorized must have a chance of succeeding in accomplishing the purpose without disproportionate loss of life. State practice since the adoption of the Charter further supports this restatement of the rules. When Israel used military force in response to threats in both Suez and, of course, in the OSIRIS reactor, both times its actions were condemned. The United States used force preemptively in the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 and Iraq in 2003. In both cases, it said that it had authorization from an international organization, not that it was acting to preempt. Indeed, the United States has not to date acted under any claimed right of self-defense, of preemptive self-defense. When the United States, the United Kingdom, and Australia, but I note not Canada, wisely, used force in the case of Iraq in 2003, none of those states justified their use of force on the basis of preemptive self-defense. There is a vague reference to self-defense in the U.S.'s letter, but the bulk of the letter and that of the other two states said that the U.S. was using force in Iraq to enforce resolutions passed by the Security Council in 1990 and 91. So in other words, it was acting with the authorization given 12 years prior to the use of force against Iraq. The United States, the United Kingdom, and Australia, of course, could not. The British Attorney General felt that that was not a sufficient basis, and the three states did try to get fresh authorization from the Security Council. They did not get that fresh authorization, and that's why many of us continue to believe that the use of force in Iraq in 2003 was unlawful. Since 2003, we find that in 2006, with regard to measures used against North Korea for developing a nuclear weapon, Security Council authorization was sought for economic measures and measures to stop and search ships on the high seas. These measures, I suggest to you, are far short of the use of force, and yet the states involved felt they had to have Security Council authorization for even those much more limited measures. So, in conclusion, the rules of the UN Charter designed to keep peace in the post-World War II era remain the law. No state may use force in a weapons proliferation case unless it is acting in individual or collective self-defense to an actual armed attack or with Security Council authorization. The basic rule, Article 2.4, against the use of force, is now widely considered to be a peremptory norm, a norm of jus cogens that does not change as the normal operation of treaties or customary international law can change. So how do these rules apply more specifically in the case of Iran? I think it's generally agreed that Iran does have aspirations to acquire a nuclear weapon in violation of its obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. For Iran to acquire weapons is unlawful and is open to countermeasures, but it does not give rise to the right to use force in self-defense as if against an armed attack. Apparently, this is well known in the international community, and so other reasons for possibly attacking Iran are being floated at this time. There are, for example, arguments that since Iran is funding certain terrorist organizations, this gives rise to the right to use force on the territory of Iran. The former Washington Post reporter Tom Ricks, speaking at Notre Dame on September 9th, stated that Iran is, for example, very active in Iraq, providing supplies, training, and perhaps even personnel to anti-U.S. forces. To the extent these activities by Iran are border incursions, amounting to a handful of low-level encounters, they do not give rise to the right of collective self-defense by the United States to use force on the territory of Iran. The distinction between frontier incidents and an armed attack is addressed in the Nicaragua case, where the ICJ held that border incidents are not sufficient to constitute an armed attack. The court said that the concept of armed attack includes acts by armed bands where such acts occur on a significant scale. The concern of the International Court in Nicaragua was with collective self-defense, where it wanted to limit third state involvement. Given the limited nature of Iranian activity on the Iraqi border, Iraq could not legally invite the United States to join it in collective self-defense against Iran. Additionally, even if the incursions were sufficient, or if they become sufficient, to meet the test of significance and control that the International Court has set out, it is for Iraq to request assistance in defending itself from Iran. The U.S. cannot simply do this sua sponte. The United States is not the victim of these wrongs. The U.S. is in Iraq today at the invitation of the Iraqi leadership. Attacks in Iraq, even on Americans, are still attacks against Iraq. Therefore, Iraq is the state with the legal authority to respond to such wrongs. The Iraqi leadership's close ties to Iran make forceful countermeasures against Iran completely unlikely. But it is Iraq's leadership that possesses the authority to make such a decision, not the U.S. If the U.S. does not like the level at which Iraq is responding to Iranian incursions, the U.S. has the option to leave Iraq and to sue Iraq for failing to make efforts within its capacity to protect Americans. What about aid to Israel, owing to attacks by Hezbollah and others? Well, again, these alleged links also appear to be insufficient to give rise to a right of collective self-defense with Israel, allowing the U.S. to attack Iran. Nevertheless, the same rules, even if they were sufficient, would pertain. Israel would have to request that the United States join with it in collective self-defense against Iran, and I don't see this happening. They would also have to report to the Security Council that they were using force and self-defense against Iran on the territory, against Iran on Iran's territory. But moreover, and perhaps most importantly, even if a case of collective self-defense could be made, the United States may only join in efforts to end the activity giving rise to the right of self-defense. It could not use force for some entirely different reason in Iran. The United States could not bomb nuclear research sites, which apparently is the main concern, in order to end incursions into Iraq or the financing and training of armed groups. It is true that a state may have reasons other than self-defense for joining in a use of force, but the force used must be directed at the unlawful basis. For example, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, the United States had the right to join it in collective self-defense. The United States very likely had other reasons to want to assist Kuwait. But the United States was restricted in its actions to liberating Kuwait, regardless of its motivations, because the liberation of Kuwait provided the lawful basis of its actions. The United States could not take over Iraq's oil fields or overthrow the regime of Saddam Hussein. Those measures were not necessary to the liberation and could not have justified could not be justified under necessity and proportionality. States may have mixed motives for using force. However, they may not bootstrap a legal basis for using force in one situation unrelated to another. Well, what if the Security Council were to give authorization then? If there's not a legal basis, would that work? I do not think in this case the Security Council has the legal right to authorize the use of force against Iran, because using force against Iran in a counterproliferation operation would not meet the principles of necessity and proportionality. It is simply impossible to sustain a legal case for military action against Iran under the current facts as we know them. I agree with Human Rights Watch that while military necessity does grant military planners a certain degree of freedom of judgment about the appropriate tactics for carrying out a military operation, it can never justify a degree of violence which exceeds the level which is strictly necessary to ensure the success of a particular operation in a particular case. Bombing will not succeed in the case of counterproliferation in Iran. This is stated by all experts familiar with the case. Airstrikes would surely not destroy all research and development sites. At most, President Obama has been informed that bombing, heavy bombing, would perhaps slow down the case for 6 months, a year, no more than 3 years. And as arms control expert David Albright has said, you cannot bomb knowledge. In this case, bombing will do very little, if any, good. And then we have to remember the proportionality aspect. Iran's nuclear sites are around very heavily populated areas. There are no effective military ways to wipe out a nuclear program that has been well hidden and broadly dispersed across the country, including in crowded cities. Several of these locations are in densely populated areas. Several are around Tehran, a city of almost 9 million people. My time is growing short, so I'll just cite to you one particular study that shows how very disproportionate a use of force aimed at slowing down Iran's nuclear program would be. Physicians for Social Responsibility have created a model of an attack on just one site, the Isfahan nuclear material storage facility in Iran, with a 1.2 megaton B-83 bomb, one of these bunker buster bombs, for earth penetration. And they found that 3 million people would die within 48 hours. To use military force where there is little or no chance of achieving the military objective, but where death and destruction would inevitably result, violates the most fundamental legal and moral principles. At this point in the discussion and in conclusion, it should not be forgotten that the international community has other non-lethal means to encourage compliance with the NPT. Ukraine and South Africa gave up nuclear weapons and joined the NPT. Libya was persuaded to suspend its research program. No military force was needed in these cases. And non-military means are judged to be the only acceptable means in going forward with North Korea. I suggest to you that international law reaches the same conclusion when applied in the case of Iran. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor O'Connell.